Actually, we have two copies of each one today.
Okay. Has anyone here read this book?
Yeah. Okay. And this is the clinical practice. And this is from 2004.
Published 2005, I think.
Okay, so basically this has a lot of amazing practical gems. And this one right here is sort of a alchemical text, Chinese medicine. Okay, really, really cool. And actually, that's how I got interested in your work as well, reading your books. And you actually have an amazing website, nourishingdestiny.com, so people can log in and join the conversation. Lonnie has been practicing, 28 years.
And I wrote my college entrance essay in 1975 on the difference between Western medicine and science and Chinese medicine and science. So I've been interested a long time and studying a long time.
And you have a fourth degree black belt in Taekwondo. Okay. And you love Jimi Hendrix, Miles Davis, John Coltrane.
I love good music.
All right, and I'm pretty sure he's excited to be here, so
yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, well, great. So this is a spontaneous off-the-cuff talk, right? So I'm teaching a pulse class this weekend on pulse diagnosis, which I've studied 34 years. And John said, why don't we do a talk on Friday night? And I said, great. So what I'm going to do is just give a spontaneous talk on integral evolutionary and spiritual perspectives on Chinese medicine. So it's really more of a talk about perspective and overarching philosophical contexts than having to do with anything technical in the medicine at all. But from a certain point of view, perspective is everything, right? Because, I mean, you may notice that, well, if we lived in a perfect world, the older a person got, the more wise they'd be. Like if we lived in heaven, the transformation of Jing in with the transcendence of fear and development into the unknown would correspond to the emergence of wisdom. So you could line every human being up by age, and the older someone got, the wiser they would get. But I think it's evident that that doesn't happen on the planet we share together, and that some people seem to find a remarkable philosophical depth in their experience and learn from it and evolve. And other people, my grandmother would say you could hit them in the head with a 2x4 and they would say, huh? So they seem to repeat the same mistakes over and over and over again and don't really seem to necessarily transform Jing into wisdom over the course of a lifetime. So perspective and how we think about what we're doing really is the most important thing, because technique and knowledge can only serve that. It can only serve that. So the context that really interests me, I went into Chinese medicine when I did, has a question, I guess, of destiny. Because, you know, how do we, you know, you meet the person you fall in love with, you live in a certain place, you find a career. I'm sure when we all came to Chinese medicine, I doubt anybody went into Chinese medicine because they thought, I'm really going to make a killing doing this. Right? When I went into it, I only knew one person even earning a living doing it. And it was only legal in 2 states in the country, and there were 4 books in English that you could read on it. I mean, there was the web. The web didn't even exist then. I got the first edition of the web the week it came out. So, and that was big news. It was like, my God, I mean, there was the essentials of Chinese acupuncture. We really didn't have much to go on back then. I didn't read a word of, I'd taken only a semester's class at the New School of Social Research in Chinese, and enthusiastically went into Chinatown and bought every book on acupuncture I could find in Chinese. But, you know, when you go through it with a dictionary, and you, Well, you know, it's easier to learn to play Charlie Parker on guitar than to read through some of that stuff. And they weren't good books on acupuncture anyway. I mean, we have better books in English than those were anyhow. So perspective's important, and I just thought I'd share what are my interests now after 34 years in the field and 28 years of full-time clinical practice. So integral, evolutionary, and spiritual perspectives on medicine. So what do I mean by integral? Just talking about integral, we could cover in 2 days to have just the beginning, but you guys out here in California invented integral, right? But there's still more to say about it. Actually, it really goes back to Sri Aurobindo, who was an Indian sage in the last century, and Jean Gebser, a Frenchman, who wrote a book called The Ever-Present Origin, which is the first textbook. It's really the first introduction in philosophical thought of a top-down perspective on the evolution of culture and how culture evolves over time. And there's a lot to say about integral, but I'm only going to talk about two dimensions of it tonight. In the first place, what I mean by integral is that it's a perspective on medical practice that implicates every accessible dimension of who a human being is and leaves no part of it behind. So we expect a person over the time of treatment to move from a relatively divided state to ever-increasing states of integrity and wholeness. So a person, wherever they come in, at whatever state and stage level of development they are at, will be relatively divided the first time we meet them compared to where they should be as treatment progresses. From a certain point of view, Chinese medicine is a science of integrity. From a certain perspective, we can say that Chinese medicine diagnoses, prognoses, treats, and assesses the separation of yin and yang, and is the science of how we can put them back into better communication, into a better functional integrity with each other. So that can be very intellectually abstract, right? That can be very intellectually abstract, but it isn't intellectually abstract when we implicate every accessible dimension of the patient. So how has Chinese medicine really evolved? What has changed in the human race? Why would Chinese medicine be different now than when the classical texts were created? Well, for thousands of years, the survival of an individual was based on factors mostly external to that individual. Is there enough sun? Is there enough rain? Can I get shelter? Can I get water? What's the weather? Is there a landslide? Is there typhoid? So the external causes of disease and external forces in shaping who we are as individuals were the most significant forces that shaped the outcome of a person's life historically, for the most part, unless you were in the ruling class. Everybody in this room has more freedom than the pharaohs. Everyone in this room has more options at their disposal than the pharaohs, the kings, and the emperors of China ever could have dreamed of. The emperor of China didn't get to say, "What would I like to do today?" He wasn't allowed out of the Forbidden City, right? He was a prisoner, basically, whose function it was on the spring equinox to face east, wear green, and say the prayer for spring, and then 3 months later to face south, wear red, and say the prayer for summer. The emperor worked 4 days a year and was a prisoner 361 days a year, where he sat on a throne with two Chinese characters over it reminding him of his job. Do nothing. Right? Do nothing. So we all share a lot more freedom today. The highest medicine in China was accorded only to the royal family and to people in the court and to people the royal family looked on favorably. It was the destiny of the average person historically to work all your life to pay taxes to pay for the emperor's burial. That was the average destiny. of the average person in China when the Nei Ching and the Ling Shu and the Nan Ching and the classic text. The people who wrote the classic text, the men who wrote the classic texts, never met a human being who wasn't owned. They never met a woman who wasn't the property of her husband. So a lot has changed. And one of the main things that's changed, and has changed historically, is that with the advent of modernism and scientific rationalism and the Western scientific method and the introduction of central heating and sewage systems and economic systems that have afforded the kind of benefits us commoners share that the emperors only could have dreamed of. Everyone in here takes for granted a level of freedom. Do you want to go hear Lonnie Jarrett tonight? Yeah, let's go. Why? Just because I want to. Because I've got free time, and I've got disposable income. Although I'm not charging you for this, but well, no one in history had disposable income except for the royal family until the mid to late 1800s. Right? So what happened in the 1800s? Well, what happened in the 1800s with the Industrial Revolution was the advent of a middle class of people with free time, disposable income, and an increasing number of options. And it turns out that when survival needs are met, and the church isn't coming for you anymore, and the state's not coming for you, people apparently go crazy inside their own minds as victims of their own minds and their own emotional, psychological processes. And you just have to look at India. India is a country with a 6,000-year spiritual tradition that in the last 30 years only has an emergent middle class, and they're giving up yoga and spirituality and going to see psychotherapists and taking Prozac. Starting to look at, they're not looking at their lives through a spiritual view anymore. They're looking at their lives through a psychological view. But the big switch is when survival needs are met, the main forces that determine the outcome of a person's destiny aren't external anymore. They potentially become internal. Right? The way our lives look is the result of choices we've made freely. Whatever condition our life is sitting here in the room right now is most significantly a manifestation of freely made choices, which we made to some relatively on a continuum of being completely unconscious about them to conscious about them, but we were still free to make those unconscious choices for ourselves. Do you understand? So from a certain point of view, over the course of treatment, what we want to see in people is we don't want their destiny, the outcome of their life, the condition of their life, to be primarily shaped by forces they're unaware of and don't understand. We want to disembed consciousness from conditioning so people are free to take greater responsibility, autonomous responsibility, for making the big choices and the big decisions in life that they have from a position of greater ethical integrity. So if we look at the forces that threatened humanity for all of time, first of all, they were individual. They faced you. If typhoid hit your town, they faced your town. But there was no threat, there was no survival challenge that could have wiped out humanity, let alone life on the planet, historically. People were just too geographically isolated. Even if a plague came through, you read these herbalists and acupuncturists who wrote, my motivation for becoming a doctor was 70% of the people died in my town. And this was their family. This was their clan, their family. And it could have seemed like the earth was coming to an end and that life was coming to an end, but there's no way it could have traveled continents and actually wiped out species. No way. Well, look at the nature of the challenges that face us today. What are they? Global warming, The polar ice caps are melting. We're in the middle of the largest species extinction in 250,000 years. People with a 20,000-year-old form of tribal consciousness are trying to procure nuclear weapons and chemical weapons that the level of consciousness they're at never could have produced, but they can pull the trigger. There's no genetically pure organic corn left on the planet that can be certified, because the stocks have been deliberately polluted by Monsanto and similar corporations. So one of the things about the natures of these survival threats are they're not individual. We live in a global world, right? Everyone in this room has transcended an ethnocentric form of consciousness. Nobody here primarily sees themselves as, I'm an Asian, I'm white, hey. Right? And walk down the street and wave at other white people. Right? You see? It's like, you don't necessarily trust someone just because they share your skin color. That's an ethnocentric form of consciousness where there's my tribe and every other tribe is the evil other. We're not at a nationalistic, I mean, the closest I can get to relating to nationalism would be watching the Olympics and kind of having a bias that the American wins. But if the American doesn't win, I'm just as happy. I go, God, that was a remarkable performance. Right? We're at a world-centric level of consciousness. We're citizens of the world. The people who wrote the Han text weren't citizens of the world. They were at a tribal level of development. And a mythic level of development, which means they shared a common bond with everybody who shared their same creation myth. But when other people came to China who had other creation myths, they'd kill them. And if there were tribes on the periphery of China, they were the Hun, and they just killed them. Right? Non-Han people, forget it. Right? So you've got to share the same creation myth. That's a tribal, ethnocentric, nationalistic, at best, level of consciousness. And we look around the world today and we see that at the leading edge we've gotten beyond that. We're at a world-centric level of consciousness. So the nature of the survival challenges that face us today, what's so interesting about them? God isn't doing it. We're doing it. The cause of all these things have only to do with our own value systems. The choices that we make, doesn't it occur to everyone here that our technological capacity, our intellectual capacity, has far exceeded our ethical capacity? Far exceeded it. We're nanotechnology. If you read Medscape every day, you know that they just created the first artificial kidney from cloned stem cells last week. That was actually able to detoxify the blood at about a level of 10% efficiency. All they have to do is get to 40% and you're good for a kidney transplant from your own cells. Next 8 to 10 years, they're going to be able to grow hearts and tissue culture from your own stem cells. These are remarkable, remarkable achievements. But are we at a level of ethics to be able to really responsibly use the level of technological development we're at in relationship to simply like nuclear power, genetic engineering, when we go about replacing these genetic sequences, when we create nanotechnology, how are we going to control the pollution from nanotechnology? I mean, how are you going to keep it out of your lungs from breathing it? Well, we'll worry about that later. So the thing is, God isn't it's not God doing it. It's not external forces. There's no white guy with a beard up there on a cloud doing this to us. And if there is, I can tell you he's not between Albany, New York and Berkeley Airport, because I had a window seat and didn't see him. Anyway, out of all the capacities in human beings that need to evolve, the evolution of ethics would be the most compelling as a medical goal. What is the medical relevance, and this is just something to contemplate, of treating Mrs. Jones for her sciatica when her species is threatened with extinction? So it's not that I'm not suggesting we shouldn't treat Miss Jones for sciatica, but what's the context in which that treatment is occurring? If we say Chinese medicine is holistic, holistic has to mean that it implicates every dimension of the human being, which implicates spiritual evolution, the evolution of consciousness. And the most manifest practical example of the evolution of consciousness is the evolution of ethics. And you only know if a person's ethics have evolved because they act better. They act differently. They make different, higher, more evolved choices based on a deeper and more profound care for a greater whole. And if you look over the course of humanity, you can see that the evolution of consciousness is the evolution of care. So if it's 100,000 years ago and you're walking across the desert and you don't know anything, you don't know anything, you're just an animal. You're an animal, but you've been given self-reflective awareness. So you know you're in the desert and you don't know anything. And you know you have to find shelter, you have to find food. You have to protect yourself. That's totally egocentric, right? Me, 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 me. And then that care can extend to mine. And if there's a little one, my other, right? Mine. Me and mine. And then there are others who look like you, and it becomes my family, my tribe, my clan, those who share the same creation myth. Nationalism is a big step. Everyone in here would look at nationalism as a fairly low form of consciousness. When politicians start waving the American flag and talking about America's the greatest country in the world, it starts to make me a little nervous. Right? Because I don't identify primarily as a nation-centric individual. I'm like, well, actually, I live in the world. Right? So nationalism is a big step, because people who are nationalism can say, well, you're Asian and I'm white and I'm Jewish and she's black and she's Christian and she's Muslim, but we're all Americans. Do you see? It's a care for nationalism is actually a pretty big step beyond just, if you don't believe in my God, you're the evil other and I need to kill you. It's a pretty big step. Beyond nationalism, there's world centrism. Right? One world, one people in the world. That's a pretty big step. Isn't it apparent that most people haven't made it? Only about 15% of the people on the planet are at a world-centric level of consciousness. And most of us at a world-centric level of consciousness are only there intellectually and not really ethically. Not really ethically. So when we're making choices about the biggest things in life, the choices aren't... When we consider a career, when you see a kid today considering a career, they might be at a world-centric level of consciousness because they live in Berkeley and they have cool parents who went through the 60s or looking around maybe the 70s or even the 80s. They're at a world-centric level of consciousness. But when they're considering a career, are they thinking, given my talents, how can I best serve the planet? Or are they, where would I like to live for college? Where would I like to go? What would make me happy to study? So they'd never identify as being nationalistic, but yet when they make the biggest choices in life, is it coming from a heartfelt, gut-level impulse to say, I recognize myself as a vehicle for the evolution of consciousness. How can I serve? What can I do? What's my responsibility? Given my talents and skills, where do I have to move and what education do I need to get so I can serve the largest whole? So moving above world-centric, what would be the next level of consciousness? The next highest level would be actually recognizing oneself as the process, as a vehicle for the emergence into this world of the process of cosmic development itself. Actually recognizing that the purely positive motive at the heart of evolution, which has been running this experiment at least around here for 15 billion years, that took 14 billion years to create life, and then another billion years to create a vehicle that could awaken to its own nature as the very impulse that has started and is running the entire experiment. That's a very high level of development, to recognize that responsibility. So the life impulse, when you work with a patient, there are two things you can work with. There's the life impulse, there's the death impulse, if you just want to break it down. So the death impulse would be, you know, wind, cold, pathological heat, damp, blood stagnation, and expressing itself through all the completely irrational, insane, and counter-life decisions a person makes that are killing them on the scale of fairly slowly to imminent. Do you see? Okay, so we want to see people making better choices. The survival threats that face the planet today face all of us. They're completely impersonal, and they're being caused by all of us, and they're all caused by the relative state of evolution or lack of evolution of human consciousness. So we need to get consciousness to a higher level quick. And the good news is that there's only one consciousness in the universe, and it's you. And you're responsible for the state of your vehicle that this consciousness is coming through and expressing itself through. And the good news for us practitioners of Chinese medicine is there is no more potent medical system on the face of the planet for touching and awakening consciousness than Chinese medicine as a vehicle. Chinese medicine was born in the context of Taoism, Confucianism, eventually Buddhism, very profound philosophical systems. But the only problem with all those, the problem with Taoism and Buddhism as destinations is that the direction is back to the beginning. So these forms of awakening are all forms of transcendence and return. Taoism is all about return. It's all about return. It's all about going back. Kidney 7, returning current. Hexagram 23, the return. It's all about going back to before the beginning, awakening to that as self, and then life is an illusion. You see life is an illusion. It's terrible suffering. Awaken to emptiness and abide there. So Lao Tzu starts the Tao Te Ching and says, well, really, you know, I'll talk about these things because you're forcing me, but words can't express them. And I don't know its name, but if forced to give it a name, I'll call it Tao, and the Tao is one. But the unnamed Tao is not the eternal Tao, and the eternal Tao is where all the action is, because it certainly isn't here. And I can understand that in a world, I can understand that as an ultimate goal in Delhi, even today for most of the people who live there, or in Calcutta, or in Darfur, or Somalia. But I do not understand it in Berkeley, Boulder, Marin, Bodega Bay. They seem to have it pretty good up in Sausalito, and you know, that little beach out there where they keep taking the road signs so nobody knows how to get to it. Yeah, I've been to Bolinas, and I didn't see too much suffering. And it's given the life that I've lived, being raised on Long Island, I mean, and I'm guessing everyone, if you even qualified for a loan to go to acupuncture school, you're in the top 3% fortunate human beings who've ever lived. Do you understand? If a patient pays you $20 a week for a community acupuncture treatment, they're in the top 15% of all fortunate human beings on the planet. I mean, there are people who work for $10 a month, 80 hours a week in factories that collapse on them.
What do you want, some more tea?
I would love some more tea. Thank you, sir. So I'm talking about Chinese medicine only from the highest and deepest perspective that I understand it at. When I teach Pulse the next few days, I'll be talking all about Chinese physiology and other things. But again, this is just overarching context. So over the course of treatment, the patient has to have better integrity. That means higher values, better behavior. And we need to see consciousness evolve from a relatively egocentric form of relationship to this little sphere. I was born on such and such a date, and I have 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 years of experience, and memories and thoughts, feelings, and emotions, and they're stored on the hard disk, and they're stored in my musculature and in my tendons, and they're stored in the body, and it's a house full of mirrors, and every mirror in there has I, me, and mine written all over it. Do you understand? And that's the world I live in, and that's who I am. And it's finite, and it's very, very personal. How personally? It's so painfully personal that I'm suffocating in it. Do you understand? It's a relative dimension of the self, and that's all I know myself as, unless I go to the extraordinary effort of hyperventilating, taking ayahuasca, doing tantric sex, getting psychotherapy, getting chocolate rubbed all over my body, jumping from a sauna into a cold pool, doing yoga nidra for hours at a time, and I'm always trying to create some other experience because being in here is such hell, but I actually like it so much that regardless of how profound the experiences I continue to pay for, consume, and have are, I never find any moral implication in any of them to actually have to live up to them, and I like this so much I just keep going back to it. So I keep going on retreat, and they say, how was your retreat? It was fantastic. Well, what are you going to do? Well, not so fast. I have to contemplate, and I have to integrate this back into my life, which means I have to only pay attention to everything that makes me feel better about who I already am, and ignore everything that suggests I'm not at all who I think I am, and something much bigger is actually going on. Do you understand? So it's like consuming, 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 consuming spiritual experience. And I have no doubt that everyone in this room has more spiritual experience than Jesus Christ had, or the Buddha, who probably never like got a catalog from the Omega Institute and said, I think I'll do this, and I think I'll do this. I think I'll do this. Right? So what we want to see is actual development. And I just have to say, look, conservative people go to doctors and they get surgery and they take drugs so they can feel better without having to change. And liberals go to acupuncturists and homeopaths and New Age healers so they can feel better without having to change. And that would, and I don't think I'm being cynical, I would say that's about it. That for the most part, we don't hold ourselves as practitioners accountable enough, and therefore we don't hold our patients accountable, and we spend most of our time getting people to feel better about where they already are. Most people, the patient can be 10 and the patient can be 90, and the attitude of most people is, whatever happened to me, if it happened to someone else, wouldn't have hurt them as much, but it hurt me as much as it did because I'm very sensitive. And the rest of my life, however, whether that's 90 years or 10 years, is completely committed to overcoming the part of life I've already lived. Which means I'm always looking backwards, a victim of my own past. And what we need to do really is, as practitioners, have an orientation in our own lives where we're done healing. Where, you see, everybody wants to be a seeker, but nobody wants to be a finder. Seeking is the ego loves to seek. The ego loves seeking because under the auspices of seeking, it gets to take a lot of drugs, have a lot of sex, meditate a lot, do a lot of Tai Chi, buy a lot of nice clothing, and eat a lot of good food. And have a lot of fantastic experiences. Do you understand? So it loves consuming experience, but it ain't never going to change. And the big illusion that the ego creates is, right now, you've got a lot to overcome, and you're getting to be ready. And I'll let you know when you're ready. But that's never going to be right now. You'll be ready in the future, and you say, well, when? Will it be in this lifetime? When there's an opening, baby. I got a lot of psychotherapy planned now. I'm in a really deep process. I'm in a really deep process, and I'm waking up to my own special abuse, whatever that was. I'm waking up to my trauma in deeper ways than I really ever have before. This is just going to take. It's going to take a lot of time, and the polar ice caps are melting. We're in the middle of the largest species extinction in 250,000 years, and the culture of healing we're in is one which inserts infinite time into the picture by trying to love people for who they already are. And beyond looking at a person during the first encounter with them and saying, I am so sorry this happened to you. It must, you know, it's harder than anything I've ever lived through, and I can only imagine how difficult it was for you. After you've said that, the only place to go is forward. So most people, the outcome of their life is determined by their own history and by forces they're unaware of and don't understand. And what we really want is for the outcome of an individual's destiny to be shaped by their aspiration toward the greater future that they can create. And it turns out that the one thing people are most terrified of in life isn't their own suffering and it isn't death. It's their own as yet unrealized imminent potential. It's the possibility of who they could be if they weren't so concerned about what happened to them. I don't, you know, people will come in and they'll blame who they are now on something that happened 80,000, if they're into Edgar Cayce, it happened 80,000 years ago or 200,000 years ago in Atlantis. I've had patients tell me, the reason I had a stroke is I cheated on my wife in Atlantis 200,000 years ago. It's like, really? It's not because you have a family in Stockbridge and one in Worcester and they don't know about each other? Could that have anything to do with it? Well, no, this is very old. That's real, by the way. So the second half of what integral means is every dimension of the practitioner's integrity. Is the practitioner's own integrity is implicated as the foundation of efficacy in treatment. All the theory we can know. You can learn to read classical Chinese up there. You can become the greatest scholar of it in the world. You can become a 10th degree black belt in whatever martial art. You can meditate for 80 days like the Buddha and become thoroughly enlightened. But it's more important to have integrity than to be enlightened. Don't we know that's true? Hasn't California seen enough radically enlightened people the last 100 years who had worse integrity than my 14-year-old, who could transmit mind-blowing states in just a second, mind-blowing states, radical states, pull people to be in their presence, you would be pulled beyond your ego into a sense of the infinite in a moment with your heart exploding. And then what? I've had 3 different women in my practice over 28 years who slept with Trungpa. The third woman, I said, you know, I've had 2 other women as patients who slept with Trungpa. She said, everybody slept with Trungpa. But it goes on and on. I won't name any other names, but just in the last 3 years, the leading figure of Zen Buddhism in the West, the leader of Anusara Yoga, well, we can't mention names, but Bikram Yoga is actually a yoga style. So, not that I'm talking about any particular individual, but the list goes on and on and on. And it's more important to have integrity than to be enlightened, right? I'll take an unenlightened person with profound integrity every time over a radically enlightened person who's got a worse ethical level of dimension. You know, the ethical dimension of them is not as highly developed as my 14-year-old. Right? So the thing about getting enlightened is we can work at it. And what enlightenment is a very big story. But the outcome won't be entirely in our hands, but our integrity is always entirely in our hands. Whether you're successful in love or successful in business or live, right? Whether you live another day, is it's not in your hands. There's always some external factor, but nothing can take your integrity from you. And to any person who's concerned with the developing integrity, it's guaranteed. Your higher integrity is guaranteed. It's guaranteed. So it seems to me to have integrity to the recognition that the life impulse isn't just an impulse, as it was considered in the East, toward transcendence and peace, toward a physiological homeostasis that's synonymous with peace. Where in this universe is peace? Can anyone point me to any peace in this universe? A woman once said to me very passionately, "My garden." It just depends how close you look. Yeah, some little worm comes up and goes, "It's a beautiful day," and a big bird comes down. The weeds are choking the plants. The garden is complete chaos. If it's a beautiful garden, it's only because you're working your fingers to the bone keeping it that way. Every plant in it's competing for sunlight and nutrients to the detriment of every other plant there. Can you imagine what it would be like to be a little animal out there? Getting up, you wake up every day and everything is trying to eat you. Right? But 15% of the people in the world live not too differently than that. Not too differently. So the thing is, I would just advocate us healers to come to the end of seeking, to be very serious, to come to the end of seeking and to give up healing. There's a big difference between healing and evolution, right? The body might need to be healed. No argument. You have diabetes, you have sciatica, your kidney's not processing creatinine well, you have whatever problem physiologically. The vessel's imperfect. It's a messy business when consciousness pushes its way into matter. This is an imperfect vehicle, but we better run with it because it's the best one we've got. It's the best one we've got. And it's not in the way. Christopher Reeve's vehicle wasn't in the way of him transforming and awakening human consciousness. When I went to graduate school in neurobiology, and I was taught the central nervous system doesn't regenerate, and Christopher Reeve was told, "Sorry, Chris, but the central nervous system doesn't regenerate," and he regenerated his central nervous system. They've had to rewrite all the textbooks because of this man, because he proved that the central nervous system could regenerate through sheer will. So, being in Auschwitz wasn't in the way of L.A. Wiesel having integrity. Being a quadriplegic in a wheelchair wasn't in the way of Christopher Reeve's integrity. For us to have integrity, we have to understand the life impulse isn't an impulse toward peace. It's also an impulse toward change. It's an impulse toward the true, the good, the beautiful. And there's a simultaneous recognition. One is everything is perfect as it is, even though this, this, and this happened to me. Everything is perfect as it is, even though this, this, and this happened to me. And I'm the vehicle for making it better. Everything's perfect as it is, and I'm the vehicle for making it better. But to make it better, we have to drop our self-concern. And who the hell wants a healer who's still in therapy? Who wants a healer who most of their attention in life is committed to overcoming their own past? The reason you don't want a healer where most of their attention is committed to overcoming their own past is because they're going to be cynical. Cynical about what? The possibility to drop it right now for the sake of you. For the sake of something higher, for the sake of a bigger care, for the sake of moving forward. So to me, integral has two meanings. Every dimension of the patient is implicated. Their soul, their consciousness, their spirit, their ethics, their conscience. Their conscience. These are all implicated in healing. And we need to see all those activated to produce a greater and ever deepening and evolving and higher integrity over time in them. And we're only going to be able to do this in them and inspire them to it by being the living proof ourselves that such an integration is possible, that such a radical integrity is possible. I consider it the responsibility of people taking money from other human beings under the auspices of healing to have an integrity so radical that their patients find it impossible to be cynical about their own capacity to move toward their next highest level of development. Because we're doing it. Our alignment with the developmental trajectory of the life force is so profound that it automatically, before we say a word, before we give an herb, before we place a needle, creates that alignment in the person's own awareness. And then all we need to do is bring their attention to that dimension of themselves. I can tell you absolutely, with no shadow of a doubt, with total conviction, without blinking, although I'll have a sip of tea, that a person can be in the middle of a full-blown hysterical panic attack and give a completely coherent lecture to a room full of 300 physicians and get a standing ovation without anyone in the room knowing what they're experiencing. And I know because I've done it. So you can just make a choice based on a higher commitment to bear what's ever going on inside yourself physiologically, because there's something that's that much more important to you than your own physiology, its limitations, and your own crazy mind. So I know it can be done. I know it can be done. So, but in order to do it, we really have to generate a care that's more than intellectual, that's more than just cognitive, that's more than just abstract. We really have to develop at an emotional level. We really have to develop emotionally so we're in touch with higher emotions than just the emotions the Chinese discussed in their texts of fear, joy, grief, anger, longing, sorrow. These are fairly base emotions in humanity. There are higher emotions like the egoless passion and inspiration one gets from intuiting the better future. The better future that could arrive for all of us if we only cared enough. That's an emotion. The capacity to intuit the pull of the next highest stage of integrity and to feel it and to be able to pre-thought, be able to feel in the heart and feel the soul pull going, God, it's so close, it's so close. Life is calling for a response. How can I act in this situation from a care for the whole that transcends any form of response I've ever had and any of my ego's own fear and desires? And that's actually an emotion that human beings can feel. So we as practitioners need to awaken at a much higher, much, much deeper, more significant level. And to do that, we just have to give up healing. That doesn't mean you don't take care of your body. That means you're done overcoming your past. That's integral. Integral means integrity. The integrity of the practitioner is implicated as the ground, the fundamental ground that is serving all theory and all knowledge in the medicine and all capacity in the medicine. There's a difference between lateral development and vertical development. Lateral development means you know more and more and more and more and more and more and more about something from the perspective you've always thought about it in. So you may notice that most people just like the music they liked when they were 16. You'll notice most people, have you ever had a patient say to you, I'm 70, I'm not going to change. I'm too old to change. You ever have anyone say this? I'm 70. I'm too old to change. Well, 21-year-olds won't say that verbally, but they'll say it with their complete attitude because it looks something like this. Whatever. Yeah, I hear you. I say to my 14-year-old son, Zeph, let's review the Mixolydian scale. Dad, I know the Mixolydian scale. Oh, really? Well, I've only been studying it for 50 years, but I must be a slow learner, but maybe we could review it. Dad, whatever, okay, okay, Dad, okay, okay, yes, 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 right? So there are two ways to avoid something. One is to just disagree, and the other is to agree. Because both of them obviate needing to actually contemplate something and coming to a deeper synthesis in yourself about whether it might be true or not. And to implicate yourself. So I would, if I were to critique the culture we all share together, would be that we have more experience and more of a top-down view than any human beings at any time in history, and we implicate ourselves less. Because we have profound spiritual experience and all kinds of experience, you know, Eslian and Kripalu Institute and the Omega Institute and 10,000 Waves out in Santa Fe and all of, you know, go to Hawaii for the week and take this drug and that drug and the other thing, and we read Alan Watts, and now we're reading the guys who write and women who write the books now, and we have all this experience. But to what degree do we implicate ourselves? We put somebody's picture up on the wall and go, hey, JC, looking good. That was good for you. You did it. Thank you. Died for my sins. Great. Okay, but when do we implicate ourselves? When do we consider it our responsibility? How seriously do we consider it our responsibility to become the type of person who has inspired us? And how long do we intend for that to take? Why should it take any longer than now? All it takes is just dropping the past. You just, okay, I'm done with that. Just put it down. So what does an evolutionary perspective mean? It's very simple. Evolution doesn't exist in the Eastern Enlightenment. There is nothing in the Eastern Enlightenment that has anything to do with evolution. And when Western translators put in the word evolution into any classical text, it's always about going backwards to something that's pre-existing, whereas true evolution means going forward to something that has never existed before, and you are the vehicle for its emergence. And that's incarnational non-duality in an evolutionary context. Very simply, the Eastern Dharma, as significant as it is, and will always be as the foundation for awakening, is about going back. It's about transcending the world, radically transcending the world. It's about awakening to oneself as emptiness, awakening to the dimension of oneself where nothing ever happened. And that couldn't be more significant as the foundation for awakening. To awaken and say, oh my God, nothing ever happened. Thank you. Nothing ever happened. Nothing is happening. Nothing ever could happen. There isn't any problem. There's nothing to overcome. To awaken to emptiness, recognize oneself as emptiness. And the Eastern answer was, that's the final destination. Abide there and you don't have to come back. Because life is suffering. I can't relate to the notion life is suffering. And not because I haven't suffered, but because you don't have to be in clinical practice for more than a few months to realize that most people are suffering more than you. And as crazy as your parents were, it ain't nothing compared to the stories you're hearing in clinical practice. And beyond that, nobody here grew, most of us didn't grow up in Chechnya or Darfur or Somalia or Biafra or even Delhi, right? I mean, Delhi is a big modern city, and if you've ever seen The Walking Dead on TV, the zombie movie, it's like give one person in Delhi a rupee and it turns into that very quickly. 700 people following you down the street until you're running as fast as you can, throwing all your money behind you. And it doesn't really do any good. So evolution is the other direction. Evolution means, very simply, we recognize an infinite developmental context without end. And not toward pre-existing conditions that we're discovering. Not toward pre-existing. So it's not that here are all the stages of awakening that we've mapped out, and you go to this stage, then you go to this stage, and you go to this stage, and then the last stage, you're a perfectly enlightened Buddha, and then you don't have to come back. And the Eastern version would be that you get to heaven and you have an ice cream social with everybody you liked in life for the rest of eternity. It's all pre-existing. We know what's happening. We don't know. We don't know. The past is dead. The future you cannot change. I mean, the present you cannot change. It just is what is. The past is dead. The present is. And the future is radically indeterminate. Radically indeterminate. And we can intuit higher potentials in the future, but the potentials we're intuiting are our future selves, if only we care enough. So Rosa Parks didn't say to herself down there in Alabama, she didn't say, well, it's not fair that black people can't ride on a bus. I think I'll go to law school, get an education, run for Congress, and try to pass some legislation. She took time out of picture and sat down on the bus. She lived right now as if the future that she intuited existed already and was just willing to pay the price to do it. And the price you'll have to pay, the price any of us have to pay, is if we live our life with that kind of radical immediacy, our values are going to change. We're going to see that some things we thought were incredibly important, we don't care about anymore. And some things we didn't care about, we're now consumed with. And when our values change, our relationships are going to change. And the ego doesn't want relationships to change because it can only locate itself in life relative to relationships. The ego is the force. It's the only force in treatment clinically you can ever treat. It's the only source of pathology. It is the force that denies integrative wholesome change. So the life force is a force. It's the one force in this universe pushing all matter forward toward higher states of integration and complexity and wholeness, toward the true, the good, and the beautiful. And the ego simply is every force inside, including all the thoughts in your head that put time into the picture. So patients say, I know what you're saying is true, and, but, here are all the reasons I need time to do them. So we can practice medicine in two ways. The bottom-up way is we clinically treat people to help get them to a point eventually so that they feel like doing what they already know is what they should be doing. So they already know they should stop doing XYZ or should begin doing XYZ, but they want us to treat them to get to a point where sometime in the future they'll feel like doing it. So what kind of person knows the right thing to do, but doesn't want to do it until they feel like it? Well, it's pretty narcissistic and self-indulgent, wouldn't you say? So it's actually the ego calling all the shots. The top-down view would be to ascertain what the patient actually knows, what they have seen of a higher nature, and hold them to the values they profess already to believe in. And hold them to it as a basis of integrity. If a person isn't living up to what they already profess to believe in, what's the point of teaching them anything else? If they're already showing they have no interest in having integrity to the Tibetan armband on their wrist, or the crucifix they're wearing, or the Star of David, or the tattoo they have, or the music they listen to, there was this song in this line in this Joan Baez tune at Woodstock about this conservative sheriff in this town who's the head of the Ku Klux Klan, and she says he sure don't think much like the records he plays. So if we're not really interested in holding a person to a greater integrity, just integrity to what they profess to know and believe in already, what's the hope? What's the hope? And then people say, well, that has nothing to do with medicine. You have to leave that out of the treatment room. Our job is just to help people feel more comfortable. Don't you know they're suffering? Well, let me tell you, they're the cause of their own suffering predominantly. It's not the church and state doing it. Nobody held a gun to their head and said, you have to marry this SOB. You have to have 7 kids. You have to become an accountant. I mean, most people, if somebody's at a lower level of economic development and not as fortunate as most of us, they've probably had to make some choices right, that they had no control over, that were dictated by financial, for financial reasons. Nobody made somebody take out $100,000 worth of loans to go to acupuncture school. That was a freely made choice. It was a freely made choice. So when I talk about evolution, I'm talking about evolution of every accessible dimension of the patient. And if we're going to have the ability to do that with a patient to the degree we're doing it in ourselves. And if we're really developing and we can back up our talk with our own development, then we're going to have the efficacy and the ability to lay a foundation for that evolution and treatment. And if not, everything else is symptomatic. There is no preventive medicine because it's essentially consciousness. If you're a materialist, consciousness is a byproduct of matter. But if you actually believe in spirit, if you think of yourself as a spiritual person, which probably most of us do, and you're interested in the spiritual practice of medicine, then spirit is the force manifesting the universe and driving it toward ever greater states of wholeness and integrity. And so then it would be our responsibility as practitioners to demonstrate a radical integrity and a relative degree of spiritual evolution as backed up through our actual integrity and through our behavior, not just intellectually, but actually just through who we are. Just through who we are. I know how serious a person has been in their study of Chinese medicine by only one basic thing, and that's how much humility they have. So it's not how well they read classical Chinese or how well they know the scientific literature or how many protocols they know for treating the divergent meridians, because all technique and all knowledge can only serve the level of consciousness that's utilizing it. Only ever. And if a person has no humility in relationship to the medicine, they can't have been paying attention. They can't have been paying attention. And consciousness cannot evolve except in the presence of at least having one knee bent in terms of humility, at least one knee bent, which means that at this point in evolution, I mean, we're all a mess, right? We're the one consciousness in this universe, this radical awareness coming through very imperfect vehicle with women's conditioning and men's conditioning and Jewish conditioning and Muslim conditioning and Berkeley conditioning and Marin conditioning and Bolinas Bay conditioning and Long Island conditioning and Dutch conditioning and French conditioning and mammalian conditioning and 100,000 years, a billion years of conditioning as life forms in the face of fear and desire and moving away from what we're afraid of and toward what we desire and having a completely victimized relationship, which conditions the heart-kidney axis, which is fear and desire, which is the relationship between Jing, potential, imminent potential, and spirit and consciousness. It's the relation, heart-kidney is the relationship between our ability to recognize who and what we are and how to live in accordance with that. Evolutionary means development without end. No final resting place, no end point. And an evolution into the unknown, not through predetermined thousand stages of enlightenment and all the different traditions. You move through this, and this happens, and this happens, and we got it all down, baby. The Chinese classics, the spiritual classics written thousands of years ago, weren't the first word on the last word on the human condition. They were the first word on the human condition. We're all just waking up. We're all just waking up. Just waking up. Hopefully, just waking up or not. But at our level of development, how enlightened we are is more of a choice than it's ever been for any other people in history. We're about as enlightened as we want to be. So that brings us to spirit. So we've covered integral, we've covered evolution, that brings us to spirit. Spirit has two dimensions, all the way up, all the way down. It's a simultaneous movement to transcend this world. Spirit is everything outside of ego. Ego is this little hall of mirrors. It's the personal, I, me, mine. Spirit is impersonal. It's who and what we all are. From the perspective of spirit, time is infinite, and there's only this moment right now. and space is infinite, and it exists in one point, and that's where we all are. And there's one consciousness in this universe, and it's you and it's me, and the same thing is listening that's talking. The same thing is listening that's talking. The universe is talking, I'm not separate from it, the universe is hearing, you're not separate from it. Consciousness is emergent through vehicles, developing in vehicles when? Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right here, right now. So that's all we've got, ever. Right here, right now. So spirit is the impulse to transcend this world, and it does it, the illusion of being separate. It's the impulse to transcend the illusion of being separate, and it does it in two directions. The traditional Eastern direction is a return to emptiness, and the evolutionary trajectory, the return to emptiness is zero. Zero, the evolutionary trajectory, which is plus one, is radical engagement with other human beings in an awakened collective to go forward together as one. Because we are one. In the recognition, we already are one. And if you already are one, taking ayahuasca, having tantric sex, isn't going to make you more one. If you already are one, sex isn't going to make you more one, because one is one. And in relationship to like all this sexual dharma these days, I have just noticed, and it may just be me, that sexuality tends to make relationships more complicated, rarely less complicated. I have limited experience in this regard, so your mileage may vary. But my experience is that when I meet people who share my values and my passion for development and my passion for consciousness, my passion for this medicine, it doesn't matter if we've ever met before, the experiences of a profound intimacy that couldn't be more so, even if they're strangers. Even if they're strangers. To the degree there's actually a passion for the evolution of values and a passion of looking, more of a concern for what we don't know than what we do already know, and really inquiring and putting everything on the table and really looking at it and really looking at best possible solutions and really expanding human capacities and potentials, I feel a radical intimacy immediately with people, and there's nothing needed to mediate it. Religion isn't needed to mediate it. Sex isn't needed to mediate it. On occasion, a glass of sake is nice. So, okay. So, what time is it? Why don't we does anyone have any questions? What time is it, though? Okay, so, great. So obviously a lot more could be said about this. As I said, this is more a Dharma talk and an overarching perspective on where we are now. This is relative, it's relative to humanity, it's relative to the practice of medicine, it's relative to the practice of Chinese medicine. I really think that we have very significant problems that face us. Chinese medicine is a radical vehicle for evolving human consciousness and for promoting wholeness. But what wholeness means is different than what wholeness meant in the 1970s, in the 1960s, in the Han Dynasty. What it means to be whole now, we have a top-down view now of culture where we can embrace Christ's enlightenment, we can embrace the Buddha's enlightenment, we can share an enlightenment together that goes further than either, transcends, is more than the sum total of both. We can all read a lab test, look at someone's five-element constitution, their eight-principle diagnosis, Zhang-Fu diagnosis, the three heaters, the whatever five pulse systems we studied, and read their lab tests all at the same time and see no contradiction in any of it. It's just all one thing. We're pluralistic multitaskers who can hold simultaneous views that contradict each other at the same time and see no problem with them because we're applying them contextually. It's a very high level of development. It's higher level of development than anyone who wrote a classic text in China because they only thought like Chinese people. Right? They didn't have the Eastern and the Western. They didn't have the top-down view of history that we have. It is hard for me to believe Lao Tzu ever bought an abacus and 3 weeks later said to his wife, I just bought this thing and now they've come out with a new one and it's got a whole extra row and jade inlay on it. Who's